And we commence our discussion of the evolution of and the continuing development of modern psychiatry, which needs to be differentiated from the psychiatry even of 50 years ago, probably. My guests are all very modern psychiatrists, all working in academic settings in the area. Dr. Will Cronin-Wett is at Northwestern University School of Medicine, and he specializes in the MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, study of biological correlates of schizophrenia, particularly, and other mental disorders as well. Dr. Mani Pavuluri is professor in child psychiatry at the University of Illinois Medical School in Chicago, and she is the director of a nationally recognized clinic for pediatric mood disorders. And Dr. Murali Rao is the chairman of the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Neurosciences at Loyola University, that is at the Chicago Stritch School of Medicine. You all remember Hamlet, and you remember that in Hamlet, Polonius says to Hamlet's uncle, who has probably killed Hamlet's father, and Hamlet is now behaving rather strangely, and Claudius asks Polonius, what do you make of this? What do you think is wrong? Is he mad? And Polonius's famous answer is, to define madness, madness is. Meaning madness is not definable. It is incalculable somehow. Was he right or wrong on that? Mani Pavuluri.
I think it's a very articulate way to say in a brief, powerful speech or phrase that he's mad, it is madness, you know. You can project what it is based on the symptomatology and decipher the various aspects of mental illness, and that's what psychiatrists do.
Yet I remind you, there are some psychiatrists, they are deviant, to be sure, from the general consensus within the profession. Tom Zuss would be one such case in point. Lang in England would have been another, who argue essentially what looks mad to us is really just a different way of adapting to a difficult world. And there's probably a great deal of wisdom in schizophrenia, which we don't properly appreciate.
Well, that was good when the knowledge was knowledge base was not sufficient. And recently, with the more and more of neuroimaging studies and more biological substrate analysis, it is found to be, you know, it was not just classification by description of behaviors, which we have always followed in psychiatry. Now we are finding the underpinnings, biological underpinnings. And as you well know, the DSM-4 classification system, you know, the DSM-5, which is yet to come, the gap between the two is 12 years. The reason it was intentionally done so that by the time, hopefully, there will be underpinnings found for these descriptions.
We should make clear that the DSM-4 or 5 and all the way back to 1, that stands for the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual produced by the American Psychiatric Association as a way of sort of codifying what we know about mental disorders. Is mental disorder still a proper term?
Well, I think it is, and I have a great deal of respect, actually, for Thomas Sass and his idea that madness is a culturally bound phenomenon and a way of describing things that's sort of a linguistic term. In some ways, that's what the DSM is. It's done by committee. It's sort of a committee expert consensus statement of what we decide is going to be madness or mental illness. But two things, I think, really bring home to me that we're dealing with. We're dealing with that it does make sense to look at these things as medical illnesses. And one is, first of all, the idea that there are incontrovertible biological changes that you see in the brain in something like schizophrenia. I think that there's no longer any doubt about that. And the second thing is that a lot of people with these mental illnesses actually lead lives that to them are unsatisfactory. And so as physicians, we look to say, what can we do to help out? And if the patient comes and says, I'm having certain problems and I wish I didn't have them, then that's a reason, I think, to identify them being as different than the population.
You are asserting, among other things, that schizophrenia is essentially a biologically based disorder.
As much as anything can ever be, yes.
A long time ago, virtually in prehistory, when I had my first job as an assistant professor of psychology at Yale University. My wife worked as a psychiatric social worker at the Yale Psychiatric Clinic, and I knew lots of the people working there. And indeed, one of the major projects, research projects, Theodore Litz ran this project, if you remember that name, was the schizophrenia study. And they were all working on the assumption that schizophrenia is generated by experiential factors. And most particularly, they were looking for the final proper model of what they called the schizophrenogenic mother. They thought that the mother was the key to driving kids mad in the schizophrenic direction, and if this was a functional psychosis. That was the general agreement back then, and I'm talking about the 1950s, the late 1950s. That was the general agreement in psychiatry, was it not? That schizophrenia was a disease of experience. Of course, it was correlated with, or rather it was mediated by, neurological process, because all behavior and all thought is, but it was a disease of experience rather than a disease of the brain.
Poor mothers were blamed for having
for everything.
Children.
They were blamed for autism as well, weren't
and
they?
And at the same time, if you look at the schizophrenics don't do violent crimes, you know, like press is reporting lately. It's very small fraction who get into that. But if you look at the matricides done, it's by schizophrenic patients. So poor mothers were blamed by the analysts and killed by the patients.
I think that you know that theory was the theory of the time, and it's okay to have theories. The idea is that you come up with a theory and you test it, and if the theory is good and has predictive value, you flesh it out and continue to use it. That theory didn't turn out to be useful.
The other major so-called functional psychosis, the two others we were told in those days, were manic depressive disorder, what we now call or sometimes called affective disorder, or now we call it bipolar very often, and paranoia in its full flower was also considered to be a functional disorder. They did not have neural or neurochemical causes, though they had neurochemical correlates once the functional disorder began. But they were caused by bad experience in the formative years of life. Similarly, for those kinds of disorders, we now view them to be organic in source. Is that right?
Yes. All this happened because of serendipitous findings of certain medications relieving these symptoms, relieving this kind mm-hmm. of psychosis. Then, based upon that, trying to find where it was working, and that's how it began. But up until then, it was all thought to be functional.
Now, I note that Mani Pavuluri works with pediatric bipolar disorder. That means kids who have essentially depressive and manic episodes.
Yes.
How early an age can that be diagnosed?
Well, to be much more definitive, the symptoms manifest in a more systematic way from about 13, 14 years on without controversy, probably. But with younger age group, it looks almost like bipolar disorder. But sometimes I really worry about overdiagnosis and misdiagnosis of bipolar disorder as much as I also worry about not diagnosing when you see one. And my favorite way to look at the disorder itself is to understand how the brain functions and the dimensionality of various aspects of the brain, like attentional problems and affect dysregulation, and the interface between affect and cognition is a better way to look at it, although these may be more represented in, you know, bipolar disorder. You know, the affect dysregulation is probably rampant in bipolar disorder.
I can't resist telling you that.
Yeah.
As a social psychologist, there are three or four things I worked on and published on, and one of them was a theory which I and a colleague developed called the affective cognitive consistency theory of attitude, structure, and change.
Well, I have to agree with you.
Well, you haven't yet heard the theory.
Yeah, well, that heading is good enough to me.
Well,
to begin
affect
with.
And cognition in normal function are correlate.
Yes.
We have good cognitions supportive of our emotional attitudes.
Exactly. I mean, in brain, there is a place called where the Mickey Mouse ears are called mm-hmm. dorsolateral prefrontal cortex that's mm-hmm. involved in thinking, motivation, problem solving, and, you know, attention management structure. And then there is an area called ventrolateral prefrontal cortex that's at the bottom of the brain that's involved in controlling emotions and response inhibition at the same time on amygdala. So this DLPFC, that's the dorsal part, the thinking part of the brain, and the emotional part of the brain, the VLPFC, talk to each other. And when that is at disarray, then that's when you start to see the wiring short circuit.
Well, I want to get back to the major psychoses that we've already mentioned and take at least a quick review of what we've now learned about the brain's involvement in the generation of schizophrenia and of bipolar disorder and of paranoia and of yet other disorders that are have been closely studied, closely researched. So, a primer on brain function in relation to grossly psychotic, delusional, hallucinatory, disordered mental functioning. We return directly to Drs. Kronenwelt, Rao, and Pavuluri after we pause for this. And we're kind of doing a once-over likely with regard to modern psychiatry. And three modern psychiatrists are our guests tonight. Mani Pavuluri is at the in the psychiatric establishment at the University of Illinois Medical School here in Chicago. Will Cronin-Wett is at the Northwestern University Medical School in the Department of Psychiatry. And Murali S. Rao is the chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at the Schrich School of Medicine at Loyola University. Will, to begin with, so what do we really know about the organic basis or the deep organic correlates of schizophrenia?
I think that schizophrenia is basically at its heart a disease of faulty cognition. Cognitive mm-hmm. processes go wrong. So the way to explain it would be to look at what's responsible for cognition in the first place. And we have any number of genes that have been implicated. These genes code for various proteins that inside the brain will affect things like neural differentiation, the way that different neurons hook up to one another, neural migration, the way that neurons go the direction they're supposed to go, and then the various mechanisms with which neurons communicate with one another. I think at the basis of the disease, we'll find that this is really where the pathology is. And then the expression comes out in faulty cognition. Schizophrenia is associated with things like delusions, where people believe things that are demonstrably false despite evidence to the contrary, and disorganized thinking, where people end up having they express very idiosyncratic worldviews, and they don't seem to link their thoughts together in a way that has any sort of external logic. This is, of course, in the most severe manifestations of the illness. But I think what you're looking at is disordered cognition that's caused by basic problems with neural communication.
If I remember this correctly, schizophrenia a long, long time ago was called dementia precox.
That's correct. Emil
meaning
Kraepelin.
The dementia of the young. But by the young, they meant sort of adolescence, flowering in the years from 15 to 20 or thereabouts.
Right. Emil Kraepelin came up with that term, and he differentiated dementia precox, dementia of the young, meaning early onset dementia. He thought that it was a progressive disease that took a relentless course but began early in life, whereas senile dementia began later in life.
But it doesn't begin at the pediatric level. It doesn't begin at the age of 5 or 6, apparently.
Extremely rare, extremely rare. Your typical age of onset is right around early adulthood. So around.
Have we seen a flowering into schizophrenia in this dread fellow in Tucson, Arizona, Jared Lee Lochner, who did those murders? From the evidence we now have, he sort of went off track only in the last year or two.
Well, from what we have heard and seen, it could be quite a possibility, because many of these diseases, many of the psychiatric disorders, unfortunately, are not diagnosed on the first day that the patient experiences the symptoms. Everybody tries to cope with it in a number of ways, and parents try to suppress it and try to get alternative methods of dealing with that problem. So finally, when it's uncovered and becomes a diagnosis, you can always retroactively see this diagnosis could have been made earlier. So it's a hindsight is 20/20 always. So.
Now, Dr. Rao, you've specialized in the treatment of and in the investigation of essentially bipolar disorder and depressive disorder especially, have you not?
Depressive disorders and the newer methods of treatment.
We'll talk about that interesting magnetic treatment that you are involved with. But to begin with, what is the distribution? What are the distributions of these various categories of schizophrenia, of depressive or manic depressive disorder, of whatever other disorders? We know roughly how many cardiac patients there are in the country. How many diagnosed schizophrenics are there? Or if we were all properly diagnosed, how many would there be?
Well, it affects about 1% of the population.
Uh-huh.
There's minor variations here and there based on a whole bunch of various factors. But overall, if you want to talk about the population as a whole, it's about 1%. And I'll tell you that that means that so many individuals in the United States are affected with schizophrenia that the cost to society in dollars is greater than that of all cancers combined.
Really?
When you talk about lost wages, disability, inability to work, and
mm-hmm.
treatment.
I'd like to add the recent statistics say that nearly 57 million Americans suffer, that's about 6%, with a diagnosable psychiatric condition. And in half of them, there are multiple diagnoses. It's not just one disease. And the most prevalent of all is, of course, depression.
You
said I'm talking about major depression.
57% of all Americans?
57 million.
57 million?
Correct.
Well, that would be, since there are about 300
million.
About
6%, they say.
It's one-sixth. It's more than 6%. It's one-sixth of the total population. That's quite a lot of mental disease.
That includes everything from situational anxiety disorders, depression,
yeah.
dementia.
Anything that would interest a psychiatrist, in
yes.
other words.
Personality disorders.
And
in pediatrics, you mean you're going to ask me a question?
I was about to ask you about childhood disorder, because that's what you specialize.
Right. One in five kids have problems with psychiatric illnesses. And when it comes to bipolar disorder, for example, there is 1% of the population that's affected by card-carrying bipolar diagnosis. And around 5% of them have spectrum illnesses within the mood spectrum of affect dysregulation that looks like bipolar disorder. So it's always a shade of this and shade of this. In child psychiatry, it's very important to understand that the illness doesn't really occur in the form of a concrete disorder, because it's like a wet hair that gets entangled. Pediatric illnesses have three or four things going on simultaneously.
Dermatologists tend to see bad skin almost every place they go. A dermatologist once came up to me at a party, a cocktail party, and said, "That thing on your face, that could be cancer, you know." Scared the hell out of me. Mm-hmm. I had to check it. It wasn't cancer. But podiatrists probably see everybody walking in a way that indicates they've got bad feet. Is it possible that psychiatrists tend to overdiagnose or see mental disorder where it really is not there? Is it possible? We all tend to make our fields the most important modes of inquiry, the most important modes of service as possible. Is it possible that psychiatrists are also prone to that error?
You know, perhaps in some areas possibilities are there, but generally speaking, like only 1/4 of depressions are being diagnosed and others don't go recognized at all. And also there's a shift in the way the diseases are presenting. 50 years ago, the onset of mood disorder was around 29, 30 years of age. Now it has shifted downwards to about 14.5 years. So there is a shift in the way the disease is presenting over the last 50 years.
Why? What will account for that shift?
It has to be explained yet. Nobody knows the explanation, but this is an observation.
Maybe the external world is more depressing than once it was.
Maybe the lifestyle, the stress,
yeah.
What we are dealing with, number of factors going to it.
You know, I think there is a risk to overdiagnose, and it's something that we in the field need to keep talking about. I think that the most inclusive definitions, the most inclusive thinking would like to take all of human suffering and somehow make it amenable to psychiatric care. I don't think that that's really very helpful, because I think there's a lot of human suffering that absolutely should not be seen as an illness. Probably the most exclusive, if that's the most inclusive, the most exclusive way to think about it would be things that we can only trace to faulty circuits in the brain, to completely ignore the fact that we do have rich psychological experiences that color our perceptions and our expectations. We look for a balance, and it's something we always need to renegotiate.
I think that my favorite way to approach that question is this: what Michael Rutter once said, who is in some ways considered as father of child psychiatry in our times, modern psychiatry, is that you understand, opposite to what you said about William James before, that you think about wellness first before you think of illness, especially when it comes to children and child psychiatry. And I always tell our residents and trainees that think about normality before you think about abnormality. And I strongly stand by it every day as I practice. And only when there is a necessity, we do give a label. But then even then, with a qualification that it could be a spectrum.
I was talking earlier about what psychiatry was like when I first became aware of it, as a young psychologist talking with psychiatric friends. And that was a lot, that was back in the late 1950s, as I say. At that time, psychiatrists were much more involved in doing what Freud or his followers called the talking cure, that is, psychotherapy. They are much less involved in it now, except for a small cluster of psychiatrists, most of them are still MDs, who call themselves psychoanalysts. That's a separate culture, now rather isolated from the rest of psychiatry. Changes in modes of treatment is a very fascinating subject, which I trust we might examine right after we pause for an update on the news, and for that to the WGN Newsroom and Paula Cooper. And we return to Drs. Murali Rao, Will Kwanenwet, and Mani Pavuluri. And Dr. Pavuluri, something I think we really ought to deal with is something which lots of people still think to be the case with regard to psychiatry, namely that it's all based upon the works of a great contributor, a man of tremendous significance in intellectual and medical history, namely Sigmund Freud of Vienna, that he really opened the world up to a proper understanding of the mind and sources of pathology and roads toward maturity and creativity and fulfillment. And he called his great new science psychoanalysis, and it prevails. That's what psychiatrists do. It's already very clear to anyone who's listened to this program, and for that matter to lots of people who know this well without listening to this program, that that isn't what psychiatrists do. That's not what the three of you do. But you've had some experience in psychoanalytic training, have you not?
I was trained like many people. I was trained just like any other residents and fellows in Australia, where I was trained in psychiatry as a part of my training rather than practicing it. But I do have good exposure to the Freudian and Lacanians and the Melanie Kleins and the cohorts of the day.
And the cohorts of the day, cohort being Heinz Kohut, who practiced here in Chicago and was the key man at the Chicago Psychoanalytic Institute,
right,
which still exists.
Right.
But what do those guys practice, and what do they research? What do they think about that psychiatrists like you don't?
You know, I actually would like to bring some connection with those old days to the modern psychiatry, where you can build bridges and, you know, learn from parts of that old psychoanalytic thinking, which is still very valuable in some way.
But is it really?
Yeah, well, definitely the id, ego, and superego concepts are timeless. It's the way you understand and incorporate into modern psychiatry makes a huge difference. Similarly, say, take cohort. It's a self-psychologist with mirroring. So mirroring is nothing but seeing good in who your child is by a mother. How bad is that to apply to cognitive internalization of positive sense of self?
So you find some real value in the psychoanalytic tradition?
Yes.
And its modern application?
At least the theoretical application and understanding has helped me to design modern psychotherapy that really is based on biological findings of functional neuroimaging that I actually am involved in research.
I'm a little surprised by this revelation from you, and quite interested in it. I wonder if that view, that is the value of psychoanalysis as a continuing mode of diagnosis or of understanding, of tracking etiology, that is to say, and as a source of effective psychotherapeutic technique. Do the other two guests agree?
You know, I have a great deal of respect for Freud, and I think that one of his greatest legacies was to give us a way to think about the human experience that was different from previous ways. And some of his successors, I'm also especially a fan of Heinz Kohut, and not just because of the Chicago connection, but they have also offered us ways to think about people. And we are very relational creatures. Human beings are very relational creatures. We need to tell stories. We need to tell our stories to other people. We need to be understood. And the Freudian way of thinking is a way to shape our stories around a common core, around a common vocabulary.
Dr. Ra.
His brilliant study of his famous cases is a model for any psychiatrist of any age, any generation, to pay full attention to the person that they're dealing with.
But we now know that those cases were in some sense significantly false and faked. Frederick Cruz has reviewed that in a book. Others have done the same. They were partly his inventions rather than accurate reports of clinical experience.
Yeah, if we had applied today's diagnostic measures on those cases, perhaps things would have been different. But the descriptive part and understanding of the defenses, the ego, and then the personality theories, I mean, those are valid to a considerable extent for all the normal people to understand how they think, mm-hmm. how they understand things, how they experience the outer world.
What about the mode of treatment, psychoanalytic therapy as such? Mm.
If you ask somebody who's gone through psychotherapy, generally they will tell you that it's enormously helpful. And I would not disagree with that at all. I think that you can often achieve similar ends by other means, but that doesn't mean that psychoanalysis itself is not helpful or not valid in some way. I think these days we try to look for a cure or a process that helps people feel better more quickly. Traditionally, psychoanalysis takes an enormous investment of time.
Woody Allen is in his 32nd year of psychoanalysis. I think by Kurt.
I'm sure he would be one of the people.
And
that would
that's
say
a four
that
or 5 days a week visit to the analyst.
Yeah. Well, we have shown that using talk therapies, we can help people feel better in as few as 6, 10, 12 weeks,
mm-hmm.
and achieve outcomes that are quite robust and quite good. So, in some ways, it's a matter of what the patient is looking for.
So, even though the disorder may have a clear neurologic basis, psychotherapy, merely talking, can effectively reduce the pain and the dysfunctionality of the disorder?
I would say absolutely that that's the case. Talk therapy is building a relationship with somebody, and relationships in and of themselves can be nurturing. And people might have parts of their mental illness that cannot be changed by talk therapy, but they may have other parts that can
be. For your disease, the one that you're so interested in, schizophrenia, Frieda from Reichmann, many years ago, believed in doing psychotherapy with very, very hallucinatory, delusional schizophrenics. And she believed they needed a lot of love. She did some papers in which she describes her technique. Essentially, she sat them on her lap and nurtured and caressed them, even while talking about their ideas. And did this, it was in one of the psychiatric institutes, in an inpatient facility, and did it for a few years, trying to bring the schizophrenic into, quote, normal function.
People feel better when they feel understood and when they feel accepted. And I think that that may have been the active ingredient. If that ends up being a transformative experience, probably the active ingredient mm-hmm. is feeling understood and feeling taken care of.
Recently, I was reading about psychoanalysis, which has not been vigorously tested using modern scientific methods
yeah.
as much as interpersonal therapy, cognitive behavior therapy have been done. So the focus should be towards that, because now what has been shown is not just talk therapy, the interpersonal psychotherapy and cognitive behavior therapy, which are all evidence-based successful methods of treatment, do affect the brain circuitry.
Uh-huh.
And that has been demonstrated. So the best we can say today is a combination of psychopharmacology plus a psychotherapy is the best that we have to offer for particularly depressions and anxiety disorders, phobias.
Well, we haven't yet really talked about psychopharmacology, but that is the great new look in treatment, isn't it? I mean, over the last 30 or 40 years. What new drugs have been developed that have what sort of beneficial effect? There's probably a list of 100 of them.
But newer drugs are only safer and less prone to have drug-drug interactions.
Mm-hmm.
But nothing has been proven to be phenomenally much different than the original antidepressant that came, which was imipramine, long time ago. There may be slight improvement, little early onset of action, but nothing substantially great.
Well, what is the name? If we could do a little bit of basic neurochemistry, what is the action of such drugs in the brain?
Oh boy, that's a complicated question, and I don't think we have a really satisfactory answer. We know that there are neurotransmitters in the brain, and neurotransmitters are the way that neurons talk to one another. Mm-hmm. And the way that the drugs work is they either affect the neurotransmission, the way that the neurotransmitters come out, or they affect the target, the place that the neurotransmitters are headed. And somehow, in ways that are very difficult to describe, that ends up changing a person's subjective experience of their mood, or it ends up changing their ability to focus their attention and concentrate, or it helps change things like delusions and hallucinations.
But we don't know why or how, really. We just know that it has that effect.
You know, we have the theory, we do experiments, we take the theory one level deeper, and then we do more experiments, and we take it another level
deeper.
Well,
now you're doing it with MRI, right? Mm-hmm. You're watching neurons in action, so to speak.
Ultimately, we still don't yet really fully understand how the brain creates the mind in the first place. So to talk about blocking a neurotransmitter to go from there to how somebody's experience of sadness improves is still very complex.
How the brain creates the mind is a great question, which has been passed off to the philosophers.
We're trying to pull it back.
People like John Searle and so on.
We're trying to pull that back into the medical sciences.
Well, can you answer that? Can you answer that? How does the brain is necessary for mind to be there, but consciousness is the mystery, isn't it? As it's often formulated as a problem, what makes us capable of consciousness? An ant probably is not conscious. A dog, we suppose, must be in some ways, but we can't quite. It's terra incognita. We can't get to dog consciousness except by some roundabout experiments.
See, the answers have come historically by the damage that occurred to the brain.
To be sure, yes.
And the most told, most famous case of Phineas Gage, where he remained conscious and regained conscious after an explosion. A big rod went through his front part of the brain. And then people started wondering what that part of the brain would be doing. Now the most famous case is the HM case. The fellow who had surgery done many years ago for intractable seizure, then he had a selective memory problem, and he recently died. I mean, about a couple of years ago, his brain has been sent to San Diego Laboratory, and it's being analyzed. And the HM story will be of much more significance because he had series of psychological testing done all along, unlike Phineas Gage.
You know, I cannot resist, even though in a way it deflects us and also it may be almost a little ghoulish. But inevitably, as you're talking about this, I'm thinking, and many of our listeners must be thinking, about the injury that Congresswoman Giffords suffered. I believe it's the left side of the brain. The bullet entered in the back and came out the front. It did not get to the midbrain. It's essentially, I think, cerebral, though I'm not. What likely recovery is possible there? I know the surgeons are kind of optimistic, but they're optimistic simply about keeping her alive and regaining some function. Is it possible that Carl Lashley's old notion of equipotentiality applies even here, that ultimately other portions of the brain will take over and serve the functions that have been disrupted by this terrible wound?
It would take a good amount of healing before the Congresswoman's higher functioning can be neuropsychologically assessed.
Mm-hmm.
So during the healing process, many things could happen in terms of positive changes in the brain and then compensatory mechanisms. When everything goes into effect, ultimately, maybe at the end of 12 months, 18 months, the progress she makes regarding her higher functions, at least she is saved as far as her life is concerned. But higher functions have to be waited out for a much longer time.
There's no ground for great optimism, though, is there?
Well, I was encouraged today when I heard that she was moving her, if I remember correctly, her hands and feet bilaterally, that she has motion on both sides of the body. That's a good sign. Of course, we'll want to hear her speak. We'll want to see how language is, if language is intact. It's going to be a long road.
Inevitably, to be sure. We are somewhat overdue for a round of commercials. When we return, I think it would be useful, it would be interesting to me, and I'm sure to our listeners, to turn to your separate research programs and examine what you've been doing in your lab, so to speak, the work of you and your colleagues, including the very interesting, rather innovative therapy for depressive disorder that has been developed over at Loyola. We'll be on to those and related adventures in psychiatric research after we pause for this. Let us now go to the laboratory, so to speak, or at least to clinical investigation and practice, and talk about the separate research programs that each of the three of you is involved in. And Dr. Rao, to begin with, this sounds like what you're doing sounds in some ways like a revival of Mesmer, almost. Mesmer, when he played with hypnosis, theorized that it had to do with magnetism.
Now, this time it was chemically induced seizures that started the whole series of brain stimulation technologies. And it so happens that the Hungarian pathologist Ladislas Meduna was a professor of neurology at Loyola.
Uh-huh.
He's the one who started with metrazole-induced seizures. And very same year, the ECT became a treatment when Cerluti and Bini started electroconvulsive therapy.
Electroconvulsive therapy.
Applying electric shock to the brain to induce mm-hmm. convulsions, which relieves, it was literally tried for everything, psychosis,
wasn't there another
depression.
Way of doing that involving tremendous overloading with insulin?
Yes, insulin-induced coma.
Yeah.
All the seizures inducing brain stimulation technologies, the credit goes to the father of convulsive therapies, Meduna. And after that, there have been varieties of things. But lately, what has become popular and approved by FDA as of late 2009 is transcranial magnetic stimulation. And the other technology is deep brain stimulation, where you introduce an electrode to go to the subthalamic nuclei, and depending on the fine point where you place the electrode, it was meant to be for the treatment of Parkinson, tremors, and rigidity. But as they were doing that, they found out that it can also affect the mood changes. So, and obsessive-compulsive disorder, TBS.
Is that an invasive procedure? Or?
That's an invasive procedure.
But yours is not invasive.
Transcranial magnetic stimulation is not an invasive procedure.
How do you
procedure.
Do it? What actually is the,
okay, the
mechanics of it?
Okay, you place an electromagnet which has a coil in the figure of number 8, which tends to make a focal beam of magnetic waves, which penetrates easily the skull, the scalp, everything, and reaches the brain. Magnetic waves don't have the barrier. The shortcoming of that is it can only penetrate about 2-3 centimeters. So what it does, it depolarizes the neurons at the surface of the cortex, which in turn, because of the connections, spreads to other side of the brain and the deeper parts of the brain. And the fMRI and the biochemical studies on the CSF has shown that it affects, similar to the antidepressants, having the same metabolites in the cerebrospinal fluid as though they were receiving antidepressant medication. So lots of patients who cannot take medications have not responded well. At least now we have another non-invasive method.
Does it tend to lower neurotransmission? To depress neurotransmission as such?
You know, at certain areas there is overactivity in the brain.
Yeah, particularly depression. For the manic side of the disorder.
Correct. Even in depression there are certain areas of the brains that are overactive, and after TMS it kind of brings it to normal levels of activity.
Uh-huh. Sort of shocking the brain into quietude.
Oh, it's really not shocking. Actually, the patient is fully alert and awake, comes and sits in a very fancy-looking dentist type of a chair, and the magnet is placed on the left front of the brain. And first you locate the exact spot in the brain which triggers your right thumb. So that is the location. And then they move the magnet 5 centimeters forward. And once you determine that location, the computer remembers that. And each time the patient comes, which is like 5 days a week for about 4 to 6 weeks, for about 30 minutes each time. So total of 20 to 30 treatments. Patient gets up out of the chair and goes to mind
now,
their business.
What are your data about outcomes?
Well, it's too early, but we have had good success, unbelievable success in a couple of patients who were treatment refractory for several years with various methods of treatment. Probably they used each and every known antidepressant alone or in combinations. But they did, two of them has done.
Are you getting remission of depressive symptoms in 1 out of 10 or 3 out of 10 or what?
The larger studies have shown that about 30% of them attain
30%.
Remission, correct. And but our experience has been limited because we just got started. Mm-hmm. So future only is going to tell how long this remission is going to last.
Yeah. Let's turn to Dr. Pavuluri. Your research, probably you're involved in many research programs, but what's the main one?
We are the ones who actually did the first cohort of studies in the world of how medications influence brain function on various dimensions of functionality in bipolar disorder and in child psychiatry, actually.
In children?
Yes, in children.
Yeah. And what are you finding?
We are finding that using the changes in the blood flow of the living brains of these children, we are showing increased blood flow with mood stabilizers in the medial prefrontal cortex, the area that evaluates emotions and modulates emotions. And also we are showing quietening of the amygdala that's overactive, like that, with a fountain of emotions.
What is the amygdala? Explain that.
Amygdala is in Greece, Greek, called a almond. So it's the size of an almond and looks like one in the base of the brain. It's an organ that's amygdala, and that's overreactive in bipolar disorder. When you actually, even you and me, when we see threatening stimuli, it's overreactive. But if it's constantly stimulated and overreactive, that's when you see mania, mostly in these patients that we call bipolar disorder. And the prefrontal cortex is unable to control this overactive amygdala. And that's, we don't know if it's bottom-up problem or top-down problem, but the frontal and limbic connections are impaired along with several other circuits. And we are also trying to work out the brain network, not just one circuit, but multiple circuits simultaneously involved and talk to each other. And that's what we're doing, how that medication changes those kinds of things. So we're just comparing, actually, the atypical antipsychotics that Dr. Will is saying just before, and also mood stabilizers, and see which one is better and where each one acts in the brain. So that's my main exciting thing to do right now.
Sounds very exciting indeed. And again, what are the statistics like in terms of remission and success in reducing symptomatology?
Around like 70 to 80% of children do get better. I think the good thing about this is that we actually use a medication algorithm, which is a stepwise, careful management of medication. And also we add psychotherapy to it. And we also have a maintenance module of psychotherapy. So we have a systematic way of approach for medication, mm-hmm. as well as combined psychotherapy. And with that special program, I think we have a success rate better than probably a random sample.
Excellent. More on the frontiers of psychiatric research when we return, as we shall do after a full update on the evening's news. And for that, to the WGN Newsroom and Paula Cooper. We're talking about the research that each of you is involved in, and we talked some earlier about the work that Dr. Cronenwet is involved in, but elaborate a bit more if you can. You're searching for the neural basis of schizophrenia. Lots of other people have are engaged in that same search, are they not?
Absolutely. I do two different styles of research. One is clinical research, where I'm looking for ways that we can enhance cognition in schizophrenia, help people think better, improve things like attention and focus and concentration. And then the other part of my research program is more basic science, and that's looking for the ways that the brain is physically different in schizophrenia. Personally, I think that it makes a lot of sense to talk about schizophrenia as being a heterogeneous set of disorders. If you look in our diagnostic and statistical manual, there's only one entry for schizophrenia, but most likely there's going to be various biological pathways that create some of the same symptoms. And what I try to do is to tease out some of the ways that people are different than one another who have the same illness.
But you and your colleagues are pretty well convinced that the ultimate source of this problem is genetic.
Yes.
So it runs in families, so to speak.
Absolutely. If you look at identical twins, we find that if one twin has schizophrenia, the other twin has a 50% chance of having it. If you have a first-degree relative with schizophrenia, you have about a 10% chance of having it. Most cases of schizophrenia end up arising on their own. But when you look in a family tree, a pedigree of a family that has mental illness, you'll see a lot of it clustered together.
Then what does that member of our audience right now who's listening and who has an uncle who has been diagnosed as schizophrenic, what is he supposed to do?
He's supposed to tell his children not to smoke marijuana.
Explain that.
We found that marijuana is what I'm trying to do is to put a useful public health spin on this, on these facts. You know, we have these esoteric mm-hmm. facts. How can we make it useful? Marijuana, despite the progressive attention being paid for its possible medicinal uses, has been found repeatedly to be an independent risk factor for schizophrenia and psychotic illness. So if somebody has relatives in their family who've had a major mental illness like schizophrenia, it might be critical for them to be aware of the risks of drug
You're
use.
You're aware, of course, that in the case of this Jared Lee Luckner in Tucson, who's done these terrible murders, there is his friends tell us that he turned significantly worse a few years ago when he started smoking a lot of marijuana.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting.
I used to live in New Zealand and practice psychiatry in New Zealand and Australia, where there are a lot of southern New Zealand population, or even in North Island there, the Maori population,
yeah.
They used to smoke a lot of marijuana, and they used to come, very potent ones, and used to come really psychotic. And we used to think it's probably a marijuana-induced psychosis, but they used to stay psychotic forever, you know, schizophrenia. In fact, marijuana increases 6 times more of there is an increased chance. Marijuana increases the possibility by 6 times of having a psychotic disorder that's there to stay.
That certainly runs against the common understanding that marijuana is sort of the mild psychotropic drug, which is virtually genial in its use because it doesn't lead you into worse stuff. That's not true.
Well, I think we're learning that it's not true, especially in the case of schizophrenia.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you were talking about what to ask somebody who's worried because there's a family history of mental illness. And I think another thing that's also very practical and useful is for people to be aware of subtle behavioral changes, especially around that critical time of emergence from adolescence to early adulthood. That's the time when most bipolar disorder shows up and when most schizophrenia shows up. So be aware of subtle changes in personality or behavior and get some attention quickly.
I was making reference earlier tonight to what psychiatry looked like and what it was focused on 50 years ago when I first began to encounter people who practiced psychiatry. And a term that was in common use then, indeed it was commonly used by Freud and all of his followers, is neurosis, as distinguished from psychosis, meaning upset and rather poor mental and emotional and cognitive function, but not crazy, not hallucinatory, not delusional. But the term is no longer used.
Yeah, it was taken into a spectrum of disorders. Most psychiatric disorders were either towards neurosis at one end of the spectrum, other end would be psychosis. And now neurosis could be a low-grade depression called dysthymia. It could be a personality disorder. It could be phobias. It could be a number of things with specific names. It's not just clubbed under neurosis anymore.
A colleague of mine at the University of Chicago, within the last few years, said to me about another colleague, not in my department, not in psychology, otherwise unidentified, said he's brilliant, But, of course, he's very neurotic. But then, if you cured him of his neurosis, he probably wouldn't be that brilliant. Is that a line of thought that makes any sense at all?
You know, that's interesting. I think there's a colloquial understanding of, a colloquial definition of neurotic, which means anxious, uh-huh. which means worried, anxious, sort of a person who lives in their head a little bit too much and tends to catastrophize and expect the worst a mm-hmm. lot. Freud didn't use the word that way. I think what happened was Freudians over the years sort of the definition of the word shifted. Freud just meant it in terms of severity, that somebody who is neurotic was healthier than somebody who was psychotic.
How do psychiatrists these days, since you've used the word healthy for the first time in this conversation,
oops,
how do psychiatrists define mental health rather than mental ill health? We've mentioned Freud a few times. He said the ultimate sign, when asked who is really psychologically healthy, he said anyone who is capable of work and love. Those are the two signs of a more or less well-integrated, effective personality.
So the DSM-5 is going to be coming out with a dimensional understanding of illness mm-hmm. that's going to be a way for us to think about people not just dichotomizing either the presence or absence of a mental illness, but talking about severity, such as depression. We have major depressive disorder right now, and people are thought of as either having it or not having it. And when we add dimensions to this, especially dimensions to some of the sub-constituent symptoms of depression, then we might end up with a better, more useful way to talk about what we would call today's sub-threshold.
Yes, but you evaded my question. Oh. Who's the healthy person?
Oh, the healthy person, in my opinion, is someone who's able to not fight with people and enjoy life and is productive and leading a self-fulfilled kind of life without harming others.
But what if there are things that you should be fighting for? Fighting against oppression.
Fighting the good fight is okay.
So, all right.
Fighting the good fight is okay. I think that with me being a researcher and a clinician, the way I write my first paragraph of any research project to convince people to give me millions of dollars is this, that a lot of patients have, this is a serious illness causing substance abuse, academic failure, interpersonal conflict, suicidality, and with a lot of loss for society. So therefore, give me these kind of resources. Therefore, these are the kinds of things that plague illness, and the opposite of it is wellness, when you're able to survive and do well.
Dr. Rao, how would you define the healthy personality?
One who would tolerate and deal with the challenges of life, stressors, effectively, and is able to use his faculties mm-hmm. to deal with, anticipate, and go along instead of falling apart. Because when we look at the model of disease, we are saying that there's a biological vulnerability and there's a stressor. The stressor could be including marijuana. So you add the two, the disease shows. But one who knows what to use, what not to use, and has a balanced life, balanced biologically, physically, spiritually, all rounded.
Now tell me this. Are medical graduates who self-select themselves into psychiatry and seek for residencies in psychiatry, internships in residencies, do they tend to be healthy people to begin with? Do they become healthy? Or is there a pattern of neurosis, to use the old-fashioned term, which is sort of characteristic of psychiatrists? You may remember that years ago there was a major study done on this at the Menninger Clinic where they found a pattern of personality which had some abnormality in it, which they thought was rather distinctive of successful psychiatric residents.
Yes, there was a time when people would go to explore themselves mm-hmm. through joining this discipline to understand themselves, but that was kind of a
seeking to still the devils or the confusions within by becoming a psychiatrist.
And the modern-day students are leaning more towards psychiatry because they're excited about the biological aspect uh-huh. of it and the newer findings,
so you're
the neuroimaging.
Because
it's the cutting edge. Actually, mm-hmm. understanding mm-hmm. the brain is at the cutting edge right now. That attracts a lot of younger students.
I think that's absolutely true. I think that psychiatry is right now where most of medicine was probably 75 years ago. And there's great uncharted territories left to explore. And I think that people that come into psychiatry now are very curious, and they want to be part of answering some of these really, really impressive questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that the most fascinating thing other than universe is brain. The second most fascinating mm-hmm. one. And therefore, it's very, very good. And we are finding, like, diffusion tensor imaging is the other one we use. And imaging genetics is the other one we use for white matter tracts, the blood flow of the function and structure, and actually putting these things together, the little pieces of brain, like the cable connections of function and structure together, is what we do also these days, or trying to do. And this is all fascinating. It's opening a window to the brain. But then what is very important and exciting about psychiatry, and we also want to remind our listeners as well as ourselves as a trainers of young people, is that there is such a thing as psychosocial psychiatry as well, that coexists with understanding brain. And it's really a biopsychosocial model that is very uniquely embraced by a psychiatrist.
By the way, how many psychiatrists are there in this country, in the world? I bet half of them, all the psychiatrists in the world, are in this country. Is that the case?
The APA membership was about 45,000. There are a lot more psychiatrists who are not members of APA.
APA being
American Psychiatric Association, correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Is it likely that half of all the world psychiatrists are here in this country?
It could be. I think that certainly psychoanalysis took off in the United States to a much greater degree.
Same than American discipline.
Absolutely. So yeah. Psychoanalysis took off here, and there was the time back in the in the 1950s, when there was thinking that psychoanalysis could solve most of societal problems. Mm-hmm. And so there was a huge rush to train as many people as we could. I think that explains a lot of America's appeal.
Right.
We are overdue for a round of commercials, but it is time first now to invite telephone calls. We're opening the lines at this instant. Any questions you want to raise about the modern pursuit of psychiatric science, do by all means give us a call. We can't do diagnosis or therapy over the air. But if you've got some questions about where one might seek proper treatment or proper diagnostic procedure, then our guests are certainly able to give you some suggestions along those lines. At any rate, the number as ever is 312-591-7200. 312-591-7200. Of course, we'd be quite interested in hearing from fellow psychiatrists or psychologists or others who work in the broad realm of mental health. 312-591-7200. The lines are open. We await your calls. If you're listening in the country where Moni Pavaluri worked for many years, in New Zealand or in Australia, you can reach us easily. And we have lots of listeners on the Pacific Rim because it's noon or 1 o'clock tomorrow over there. And we do often get emails from Australia and New Zealand. So if you want to email us from there or any place in the world, do by all means do so. The email address, extension 720 at WGNradio.com. Extension 720 as one word at WGNradio.com. Or for calls again, 312-591-7200. Onto your contributions after these words. And we will go directly to the phones for your questions and comments to Drs. Murali Rao, Moni Pavaluri, and Will Cronenwit. One might note that both Drs. Rao and Pavaluri are, of course, from India originally. Isn't that right?
That's right.
Yes.
There are lots of Indian physicians in all specialties in Chicago hospitals, particularly in the ones associated with medical schools. What accounts for that?
That's throughout, not just in Chicago.
So all over the country.
All over the world.
The world.
If you go to Australia, New Zealand, NHS in the UK.
So all the more urgent is the question, what accounts for that?
Because the population is 1 billion strong country.
Indeed, yeah.
And the other billion is China.
Uh-huh. But there are very few Chinese psychiatrists in practice in Chicago.
I think personally the British have taught us English, and it was easy for us to do medicine, and we kind of embrace this profession. And there are lots of professionals in our country, and there is not a brain drain because a lot of people in India too.
We will now go to the phones, 312-591-7200, and Ben is first up. Good evening. You're on the air.
Thank you. A good friend of mine was diagnosed years ago. She was schizophrenic, or she is schizophrenic, but she's adopted. So I'm just curious how they can retrieve history if they're doing any sort of therapy with her.
Well, would they need to retrieve history?
You know, I don't think that knowing an individual patient's history would always be very helpful. Certainly you want to know what's going on, and you'd be very curious, and it might help to predict the future if that person was going to start a family of their own, which I hope they're able to do. With adoption, frequently it's difficult.
Okay, great. And one other quick question. Why is it that people with these sort of problems, they almost feel like everybody's against them, or, you know, they're the only one without the problem?
You know, the schizophrenia, generally speaking, is like a person doesn't belong to the society. In the same way that person afflicted with the disease also feels that society is not a part of him. So they're stranger to one another.
In some ways, they share a different reality. They share an actual different reality. They live in what feels like a very different world. And oftentimes, it's a struggle to try to communicate that to people. When they try to communicate what they're feeling, they're met with looks of surprise and people who don't fully understand what it is that they're trying to say. And that could be a very rough battle to fight day after day.
Okay, great. Thanks, Bill.
We thank you, sir. Glad to have heard from you. 312-591-7200 is the number. And next up is John. Good evening, sir.
Oh, it's me, Paul.
It's Joan, I guess. Yeah. I'm sorry.
I was calling to ask about alcoholism. Is it considered, and I'm going to make it general, do you think it's completely physical, or are there mental problems? How do you treat that? I'm making it very broad, so because it is a major problem.
And, of course, the Alcoholics Anonymous line on this is that it is a genetically built-in disorder, which will inevitably emerge unless, and then you have to remain sober through all the rest of your life, but always call yourself an alcoholic.
You know, a difficult-to-treat alcoholism case, one should carefully look into what else is going on, because dual diagnosis is recognized more and more as we are paying more attention. For example, people with mood disorders have a comorbidity, that means a co-occurring dependence on drugs or alcohol, to the tune of about 85%. So it's very important to treat both alcoholism and the mood disorder simultaneously. There was a time when you would treat one and then come for the other. That's never practical. Treating both simultaneously is the only answer. So to look for what else is going on is very key.
What is mood disorder?
It could be temperamental changes at a certain level, to major depression, to going through mood swings from irritability, anger, then manic type of activity, doing impulsively things with poor judgment.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that is a disease or not a disease then?
That is a disease, and that is the kind of disease that goes closely to the drug dependence. So that's what makes the treatment of drug dependence alone difficult if we didn't recognize the other part of it.
Can alcoholism be cured, or you completely cannot drink? I mean, what does that mean then?
You know, I think it's helpful to think of alcoholism also as being different. As there are different types of alcoholism. In some cases, it's clearly genetically determined. In other cases, it seems to be more sort of a learned behavior, and without such a clear genetic basis. And I think if a thing to do would be to talk with the physician of your choice about what, you know, particular risks might be going on in people who you know, and that would guide the particular style of treatment that might be most successful. But I want to say, yes, there are people, absolutely, there are many, many people who quit drinking and stay sober and lead fully productive, happy lives.
Ma'am, we thank you for the call.
Thank you so much.
Here's something that is right up Mani Pavaluri's line of inquiry, I think. I'm reading an email. A close friend of mine has bipolar. She is married to a man who is bipolar. Both can be quite explosive if their meds aren't working right. They have a toddler right now, and she really wants to have another child. This scares me and many others because of the explosive history. Then there's the other obvious concern. What are the chances of their children being bipolar? Are there ethics to be considered when having children in this case? If a bipolar person wouldn't wish their condition on another human, wouldn't it be a selfish thing to have children in this situation with both parents being severely bipolar?
There is, you know, with this kind of situation, there is a 75%, you know, genetics do determine that if the parent, both parents are bipolar, then there is a 50 to 75% chance of the child being bipolar. But what about the 50 to 25% of the children who do not have a disorder by the virtue of the incidence, you know? So there's always a gatekeeping situation that's ethically you're restricting as well as permitting a serious disorder or a healthy human being. So I think it, at an individual level, it is for that person to consider, but with due counseling and understanding when they are mentally stable, at least. And I think that in this risky situation, I think early screening for children with any behavior problems, either for psychosocial or disruption due to explosion in the family or for genetic reasons to get checked would be a good thing to do.
We will be directly back to the phones after we pause for a quick news roundup. And I might note that now there are one or two lines available at last. They've been completely taken until this moment. If you've been trying to reach us, you've been hitting a busy signal. But try again. Somebody will get through at 312-591-7200. There's also considerable accumulation of email. We'll be reading more of that. If you want to email us, the email address, extension720@wgnradio.com. And with that, to the newsroom and Paula Cooper. As we continue in our discussion of modern psychiatry, there is a modern psychiatric problem with regard to the hospitals that were shut down some years ago. The point has been made often with regard to Jared Lee Lochner in Tucson that if he had developed these, if he were 50 years older and had developed these symptoms as a dementia precox kind of thing as he was coming towards his 20th birthday, he would have been institutionalized in all likelihood 50 years ago. I know that this coincides with a concern that you've got, Dr. Rao. Let's talk about that just a bit before we go back to the phones.
You know, for chronically mentally ill patients, there used to be state hospitals which would keep them for months or years, as long as it took.
Or sometimes even for a lifetime.
Correct. And they were protected. They were taken care of. And the society was protected. And, you know, it was a mutual exchange. Now, with the countrywide decrease in state hospitals and in the remaining hospitals, there has been a drastic reduction in the number of beds. And that leaves the indigent, chronically mentally ill patients be on the street or be hospitalized briefly for 4 or 5 days through revolving door system or get incarcerated for trivial mm-hmm. crimes or major crimes. And we have highest percentage of mentally ill incarcerated condition in our country. And where did they come from? I mean, if there were to be state hospitals, I bet those numbers would have been much lower.
What would have happened in this country 40 or 50 years ago if a kid like Jared Lee Lochner was found disrupting his high school or his college classes, and people were really worried about his being potentially dangerous? What would have been possible within the realm of law and psychiatry?
You know, it's hard to say for sure, but I'll tell you that the society has always struggled with what's the appropriate level of involuntary treatment and involuntary mm-hmm. assessments that we can give an individual. On the one hand, we want as much as we can to take people who we have any fears about and give them as much treatment as we possibly can. That's the, that would that is, we'll call that the most sort of paternalistic attitude. On the other hand, the other extreme is we want to always respect individuals' autonomy. We don't want to make an error and take away somebody's civil rights, lock them behind a locked...
And the ACLU is there to tell you to live by that standard.
Well, it's a constant tension, and I think we have a pendulum here in our society that swings back and forth. Mm-hmm. There are times when it is easy to take people and treat them involuntarily, and there's times when it's much more difficult. And we're still struggling to find what the appropriate balance is.
The states vary somewhat in the relevant laws that they follow.
That's correct.
What's true of Illinois?
Not too restrictive. I mean, it's fair because there are other states where, in the name of freedom, you cannot do anything, even when you're seeing, unless that individual has done some act that is demonstrated to be dangerous and has actually harmed somebody.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot do anything until that happens. So that becomes very restrictive. There was a famous paper, Dr. Trefford from Wisconsin had written several years ago, Dying with Your Rights On. So, you know, like Will was saying, to what extent you honor and respect mm-hmm. ones, those who are capable of enjoying the freedom or even appreciating freedom.
Of course, there are countries, the Soviet Union was certainly one of them, in which psychiatric imprisonment was used routinely to stifle political dissidents.
Well, that's an absolute abuse of psychiatry. Yeah. I like to think of psychiatry as being a discipline full of healers who try to help people overcome challenges. And to use psychiatry as coercion, I think, is just absolutely inhumane. And certainly our field has a sort of a checkered past about substitute.
In that regard, yes.
Right. Even here in the United States, sometimes psychiatrists have substituted their judgment for their patient's judgment when it wasn't strictly necessary, and we have to overcome that legacy.
We go back to the phones, 312-591-7200, and Angela joins us. Good evening. You're on the air.
Good evening. I have a question. I was diagnosed with a couple disorders, one being, or initially being major depressive disorder, and then secondly being dysthymic disorder. At the moment, only major depressive disorder. How is that possible?
Well, major depressive disorder by nature is not a constant thing. You know, with or without treatment, it fluctuates in its course. Sometimes the depression is much deeper. Sometimes it's much lighter, more manageable. So that could be, depending on the cross-section, depending on what time you saw which doctor, whether you are severely depressed versus whether you are having only some symptoms of depression, that diagnosis could have varied. But if you take the big picture and add up everything, it's a recurrent illness. It's a major depression vacillating in its course.
And we thank you, ma'am, for the call. And let me read you another email that I find quite interesting. I was wondering, says this listener, if your guests would care to comment on the experimental use of psychomimetic drugs, Paren, LSD, MDMA, etc., the use of such drugs in therapy.
Well, we've learned a lot about mental illness by the experiences of these drugs. We've learned a lot that when you give somebody a medication or a drug like LSD, for example, and it causes psychosis...
They go crazy, in effect.
Well, they experience symptoms that are very yeah. similar to schizophrenia. By giving people medications like that, we've learned a lot about some of the biochemistry of schizophrenia.
But I think what this listener has in mind is the use of such drugs to supposedly produce a psychotherapeutic effect.
So one of the ones that people talk about frequently is ecstasy, MDMA,
uh-huh.
and I just heard that was actually back in the news. It's been banned in the United States, a controlled substance in the United States for a long time, but back in the 1980s when it was available, people would take it in therapy sessions because it would enhance people's sense of empathy and well-being. Once we realized that it was dangerous and had an abuse potential, it became illegal. But just recently, there's more people that are doing some sort of experiments with it to see if it can, you know, to see if enhancing that feeling of empathy can somehow be therapeutically useful. I say tread with caution. I say be extremely careful. It's very, very, very experimental.
It's worth remembering that LSD first came into use at Harvard University under the the guidance of Timothy Leary, who then was a professor in the psychology department. And whatever his real motivation was, I think his motivation was for him to get high and enjoy himself and lose all of his ordinary inhibitions. But he presented it as a mode of psychotherapy, or as a way of deepening and enriching personality.
I think you end
until
up...
Until Harvard kicked him out.
Right. So, I mean, it changes your... Let's call it a fantastic experience. You have a fantastic experience of some sort. Maybe it's a religious experience. Maybe it's taking a psychotomimetic drug like LSD or mushrooms. You have a really deep, rich experience, and you feel like it changes you. You feel like it's transformative.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what sort of drives it. Somebody takes a drug, they feel like they're really literally in a different world. They have revelations. They come out of it, and they want to share it with people and think that it leads to insights.
We go back to the phones, 312-591-7200, and next up is Diane, who's joined us at WGN Radio. Good evening.
Good evening. Thank you so much for taking my call. My question is, if you could talk a little bit about how nutrition, and I've heard like B12, if your levels are low, that can cause more depression problems, and if you could discuss a little bit about that and if you've done any work on that type of research.
You know, in any basic diagnostic workup, nutritional status is assessed, and the good indicator of a nutritional status is checking the B12 and folate levels. So it's something that you generally don't miss. And, you know, one rule in psychiatry is that you make a psychiatric diagnosis only after all the physical diagnoses have been considered and ruled out to explain the symptoms.
I'll tell you, I've had a blood test many years ago where it came up and B12s were in a normal range. On the report itself, it would say if they were in the low levels that you would have higher incidence of depression, which was never pointed out to a and a doctor never pointed that out, that maybe, you know, I should take supplements and things like that of B12 to help with that. So that's why I was just wondering if... You know, that's been studied more, or if things like that would help out some people that have those problems.
I think that, you know, a lot of children that come to see me, for example, they go to a fever center in Chicago somewhere, swearing by the use of vitamins being very helpful with zinc deficiency, vitamin B12 deficiency, etc. But my standard answer is there is no proven evidence base for something like that. Although unknown does not mean it's a bad thing to do, but I cannot advise you on that. And right now, the field is not really endorsing it.
Oh, okay.
What we don't know is what we don't know.
Okay. All righty. Thank you so much.
Thank you, ma'am, for the call. Here is a call, I gather, from Pennsylvania. Is that right? Hello? Well, if he's in Pennsylvania, he's not listening properly. So we'll go to another caller, 312-591-7200. And David has joined us. You are on the air. Good evening.
Hi, doctor. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
I, in the last 2 or 3 years, I picked up this panic attack type of thing where I was afraid to walk out of the house, and no matter where I go, I couldn't wait to get back home. And I kind of was thinking, what causes that, or how did that happen to me?
Well, sir, we can't answer questions of that sort. That would require a closer examination and some contact with a relevant psychiatrist or psychologist. Where might he find that kind of help?
I can answer generally is that, you know, when a person develops, this is all classified under anxiety disorders, when a person experiences an acute panic attack in a given situation, that person learns to avoid that situation. Then he starts further developing phobia about even thinking about being in such places or situations. So this is all the complex disorder. And then further on, the follow-up studies have shown that they do show evidence of depression sooner or later. But the neurochemical answer, neurotransmitter-wise, what psychopharmacology can offer is the same treatment is what's offered for depression. So that can take care of both panic symptoms as well as the agoraphobia and depression.
What are the preferred drugs these days?
SSRIs are the most commonly prescribed.
Explain what that means.
Selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. They are the class of drugs.
Yeah.
The first one of the series was Prozac, and a number of them have come in that series.
The psychiatrist who did a book about Prozac as a great liberating force was a guest on this program once.
Kramer.
He scared the hell out of me, as a matter of fact.
Peter Kramer, right?
Yeah, that's
listening to Prozac.
Listening to Prozac.
He was a fan. He was even talking about broaching the subject of allowing people who didn't have a diagnosable mental disorder to take Prozac experimentally to see if they might overcome things like simple shyness.
Well, he was advocating sort of everybody getting Prozac as a way of opening up richer life experience.
I have a big issue with Prozac, actually, being a doctor practicing treating children with bipolar disorder. Sometimes the giving Prozac to everybody is an issue for me, because that serotonin increase can cause worsening or bring upon a predisposed condition such as mania if it is present or potentially possibly manifesting would come out. So I would use it sparingly, carefully, especially in the kids with any inkling of behavioral problems that are sort of inflammable.
I think it would be interesting to ask Dr. Kramer if his views have changed over time. I think our experience with the antidepressant medications has been that when they first came out, we were very, very enthusiastic. And our experience has shown that a little of that enthusiasm was we were a bit too enthusiastic.
Isn't that in a way the course for virtually all psychotropic drugs as used?
Prozac was the first drug that made both the Time and Newsweek covers as a drug.
Really?
Because within about 8 or 10 months after it was introduced, it hit a $1 billion market that had never happened to any drug before.
And medications in that class are still what we would consider standard of care, meaning most psychiatrists, including myself, would feel very comfortable prescribing them for somebody who had depression or anxiety. That being said, we've learned over the years that they don't work quite as well as we thought. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't prescribe them. It just means that depression is still a very complicated condition.
That's my point.
Condition.
That's what you learn about just about all such drugs.
Everything in moderation, and everything has its right place.
I know a great drug for most psychiatric disturbance, and that is an occasional glass of a good red wine.
Right. Oh, well.
We are overdue. A last round of commercials, then directly back to the phones on 312-591-7200. And as we approach the end, we'll be back to the phones in a moment. But here's an interesting email I've got that I do want to get you your reaction to. It is perhaps worth noting that our very own Mayor Daley had a strong hand in the authorship of the Illinois Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities Code, which was fairly progressive. Unfortunately, certain provisions, such as, quote, informal admission, have proved moot, and there is little improvement in sight. The University of Chicago has outsourced inpatient psychiatric care, for example. It's a pretty rough gig to look at in terms of whether it will turn a buck. That's sent to me by Greg. Does that have meaning for you?
Yeah, that's been the trend throughout the country. I mean, most of them have parceled out the inpatient treatment because our payers in the managed care also parceled out the mental health part. It's a carved-out system. So accordingly is the game played.
Parceled it out to what or to whom?
To mental health management companies, managed care companies.
So Northwestern still has a very strong commitment to inpatient care, but I think we recognize that when somebody comes into the inpatient unit, that should always be an opportunity to reflect on why they're there and what happened that they couldn't keep working as an outpatient. So as we're building a brand new inpatient unit that's going to be opening soon. It's going to be quite nice. But at the same time we're building the new unit, we're also working on things like community-based case management teams that can go to people's homes, help them administer their medication at home, take them to doctor's appointments, take them to the pharmacy, and other sort of supportive measures that would hopefully make the inpatient unit less necessary. That being said, I think every illness is going to have exacerbations where people need acute treatment.
And the new healthcare system given by the the recently passed legislation, which is still, to be sure, under argumentative reexamination. But this new health care provision system, so-called Obamacare, how will all of that affect the distribution of psychiatric treatment?
You know, in some ways, the margin in psychiatry is so low that I think we're not going to be, percentage-wise, we're not going to be asked to give up very much. We're not going to be asked to change very much about how we practice.
Uh-huh.
It's a very low-margin type of medicine.
Let's go back to the phones. A few more calls possible in the remaining 5 minutes, one or two more calls. And next up is Sivan, I believe. Hello, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, doctors. Thank you so much for taking my call. I work in an inpatient setting. I was wondering what your feelings were regarding the older antipsychotics as opposed to the newer ones. I didn't know if you're, in your practice you still utilize Thorazine and Haldol, which to me, I know they have the long-term side effects, but I'm not seeing that much success as far as with the Zyprexa and Seroquel. I know there's all those metabolic issues, and I was just wondering if you still use the older ones in your practices and or if those are going to be gone.
Dr. Pavaluri?
Oh, yeah. Across the spectrum of disorders in general from and my own experience, it's just very possible that we need to resort to some of the older antipsychotic medications, mostly in the treatment-resistant cases. And I think it's very it's reasonable to say that within the atypical or second-generation antipsychotic medications, there is a certain there are certain medications that are used for certain things, and some of them are not as effective as others in general. So I think that a judicious choice of newer second-generation antipsychotics with a backup of old ones, if the newer ones don't work, would be a good choice to go for, I think.
Okay, that's great. Thank you so much. We enjoying
thank
the program.
You. We thank you for the call, ma'am. 312-591-7200. I think the last call coming up, and it is from Donald, who joins us now at WGN. Good evening.
Hi, thank you very much. I'm involved in a religious outreach to people with mental illness in some intermediate care residences in Chicago, and we have every 2 weeks the same five or so people from a residence and volunteers who spend about 2 hours in effect sharing Christian faith through a particular process, which seems to make the people from with mental illness from these residences comfortable. They're in a safe place. They can talk. They have someone who talks to them and who respects them. We don't expect necessarily that they're going to get better, and that's not our expectation. Our hope is to treat them as individuals who happen to have a mental illness and who need respect and normally sort of discarded by society.
You know, that's the exact kind of support that you're offering that works best, where it's not demanding on them, which is not expecting anything in return, but just offers them support, a belonging to a group. That's wonderful.
I was going to say that many of them have a very deep religious faith, and they live in circumstances which I would find next to impossible to, you know, 24/7 being in an institution. But nonetheless, they have a meaningful life. Some, and the ones that I'm in communication with, have a meaningful life. That they look, you know, they have a meaningful life.
Sir, I fear we're just about out of time, but a last comment on this from Dr. Cronenwitt.
I also wanted to say, to express my appreciation for your work, especially for your volunteers. That is excellent work. And I know that people who have a strong faith tradition feel that faith is practiced better in groups. So I think offering somebody an opportunity to come together like that is really quite useful.
And our thanks to that caller. I should have mentioned earlier, I'll do it rather quickly now, that we put a number of new classic Extension 720 programs up on the website. You can get the podcast, listen to it in immediate streaming, or download it for later listening. We've just put back the program with David McCullough, the great American popular historian, and when we discussed with him a number of years ago his book, his biography of John Adams. Also available as another classic is our conversation back in 2001 with Henry Kissinger, which remains very relevant to an examination of America in the world and our problems in the world. More recently, of course, we put up some recent programs, including the one last night on about fugitive justice, that is the handling of runaway slaves in the 10 or 12 years before the Civil War. Our program on the tragedy in Arizona from just two nights ago is now available on the Internet, as is another program with Mortimer J. Adler, which we found in the treasure trove. This is his discussion with me quite a number of years ago about his book, The Angels and Us. And with that, we are just about out of time. Time only to thank Drs. Rao, Cronenwet, and Pavel Luri for an excellent and most informative conversation, and some excellent calls, for which I'm very grateful. We'll be with you again Sunday night. Until then, thanks to all for listening, and a most cordial good night.